Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Scarlet Thread Society. Now, before we begin in earnest, I'd like to go through a few safety precautions with you. If you have not done so already, please lock your doors, cover your mirrors, throw down your salt circle, and if you enjoy tobacco as I do, this would be an excellent time to light some. Now, with those safety disclaimers out of the way, let's talk a little bit about expectations. Here on the Scarlet Thread Society, the final Friday of every month, you can expect two segments, in the first of which I will be going through email, submissions, and stories that have come in from you, the audience, and as necessary, perhaps discussing some of the finer points and details involved with them. In the second segment, we will get into a dedicated research topic each month. Here, in episode 1, we will be going through the very freshly declassified CIA UFO files. Now, before I go spoiling any of that, though, let's hear from all of you first. Professor, I have had a few paranormal encounters over the years, but one that stands out is my encounter with the ghost of Jim Sawyer. Jim Sawyer was a drug dealer who sold heroin at my former place of employment, the Lion's Lair, located on Colfax Avenue in Denver. He was stabbed to death in the bathroom at some point during the 1970s and now haunts the place. Once, after closing down, I unplugged the jukebox, turned down the lights, and sat down for a cool glass of Old Style. That's when the jukebox turned on and started blaring Jimmy Cliff's The Harder They Come. The bathroom door slammed open and shut, and the lights flickered on and off. The bathroom has no ventilation, as Carr Campit can testify, and the jukebox was firmly unplugged. Now that's some super spectrum activity. Love 20 tons of steel. And just let me tell you, 20 tons, we love you right back. Thank you so much for writing in. And I just immediately point out, I love your use of the super spectrum there at the end. It's pretty well known, I would imagine, by this point, that I am very partial to the Keelian perspective and the ultra-terrestrial hypothesis that perhaps there's something lurking directly in our world that is just outside of our perceivable range, that's, you know, sitting right there outside of our visible spectrum or outside of our interactive interface with our reality. I think that this story could potentially lend a great deal of credence to that. When you examine the fact that a jukebox should not be able to play if it's not plugged in, that doors cannot open and close themselves without some sort of force acting upon them, whether that be a person's physical energy or some sort of wind gust. But as you made very clear, that wasn't the case here either. I think you found yourself in a very legitimate ghost encounter, and I gotta say, I'm glad you were able to play it as cool as you did. Thank you so much for writing in 20 tons. Our second submission, we have a ghost story from none other than longtime mutual and legendary author, Spivonimist. Walking the glittering streets of Denver, it can be easy to forget that until recently, Colorado was rough territory. The last stop for cattlemen, a mountain refuge for men as tough as the wind-beaten trees girding the Rockies. Husks of former gold mining towns now serve wealthy coastal elites who sip $30 cocktails as the sun slips behind elegantly groomed ski runs. But the old mine shafts are still there. You can find them if you have the courage to trek into the back country. Some of them have been barred off, ostensibly to keep curious teenagers out. But as anyone who has set up a tent for an overnight stay near an old shaft knows, there are things that need to be kept in as well. In early autumn 1994, I had a month or so off between duty assignments. My nuclear prototype training in Idaho gave way to a sea tour in Washington. Since I had little interest in farting around Seattle for the interim, I accepted an invitation from a roommate to go chill at his childhood home in Evergreen, which at the time was still a fairly modest town, boasting no more than a few thousand residents. Historically, Evergreen served as a pit stop for prospectors. In more modern times, this podunk little mountain town can claim residents including Willie Nelson, John Hinckley Jr., Trey Parker, and Berkeley Breathed. Its exceptional claim on celebrity is exceeded only by its exceptional claim on murder. Though the overall crime rate tends to hover near the national average, and most crime is simple larceny or petty vandalism, occasional outbursts of absolute heinous carnage erupt from time to time. The relevant case here supposedly occurred during the week of D-Day, which helps explain why newspaper records of the massacre are all but absent. The story goes that on an extended Boy Scout camping trip, the fellow in charge of the expedition murdered the half dozen or so boys as they slept. He'd done it with his knife. Ever since, the rickety shack they used has been affectionately known as the Stabbin' Cabin. I do not know if the Stabbin' Cabin still stands. It was built on one of the few alluvial zones along the Bear Creek, making the land unsuitable for proper development. Regardless, it was still there in 94, and even before I learned the story of what happened there, I could tell at a glance as I drove past it for the first time that the place radiated menace. My buddy suggested one day that we go check the place out. Though it was walking distance from the house he grew up in, he had never mustered the courage to go check it out in person. We decided to go at noon on a cloudless day. The first thing I noticed was the paint. The place had supposedly been abandoned since the murders half a century earlier. Yet the exterior paint was more or less intact. This is Evergreen, Colorado. Annual snowfall is bonkers, even on this side of the Rockies. Someone had to have been out there to put a fresh coat of juniper green on there at least once in the prior few years. The next thing I noticed was the chalk art. The front of the cabin was dominated by a large front porch. On this porch were six chalk portraits. I don't mean crude sketches either. Though they were heavily faded, it was eminently clear that when freshly completed, the images would have been professional quality and in a style you didn't often see, even in the 90s. It reminded me of classic newspaper strips, almost a Winsor McCay style. The details were lost to time, but the color gradients remained. The next thing we noticed and remarked upon was that despite the outside temperature being in the upper 60s, maybe even low 70s, our breath started to fog as soon as we stepped past the threshold. The chill inside the small, uninsulated cabin was almost comically unnatural. I have been inside warmer walk-in refrigerators than the interior of that building. There was also a smell I couldn't place, not at the time, anyway. I encountered it again years later at an ossuary near Karlovy Vary in the Czech Republic. It was the stench of antique death, the sigh of dry bones. And then there was the sound. Navy nukes tend to develop tinnitus, regardless of how diligent we are with hearing protection while in the engine room. I have it, my old shipmates have it, damn near every nuke I've ever talked to has it. At the time, I didn't have it yet. My hearing was quite good, in fact. I therefore remember being somewhat startled at a sudden bout of low-grade tinnitus that began as soon as I entered the room. It was the sort that seemed to pulse, as if modulated somehow. The cadence of the modulation seemed to mimic speech patterns, almost like someone were trying to talk to me. But all that came through was a high-pitched whine. Soon enough, the headache induced by that place became too much to bear, so my friend and I jointly decided to vamoose. The little time we spent inside gave us the willies bad enough to scamper up on out of there, but not so bad that we didn't pause to take one more glance at the chalk art on the porch. This time, instead of being blurry and faded, two of the images were absolutely crystal clear, as if they had been completed just that day. Every detail of those two faces stood out sharply. Kids. Boys. Maybe 13 years old. The look in their eyes was chilling. It was the sort of expression you see in portraits of condemned men just before execution. A mix of pain, despair, and sorrow. Needless to say, the remarkably clear portraiture was enough to get us to hightail it out of there. And that's about it. It wasn't the strangest thing that happened to me on that trip, but it was the closest I came to a classic supernatural encounter. I sometimes wonder what would have driven a guy to just up and slaughter half a dozen kids while out on a camping trip. But then, I've been inside a couple of those old Colorado gold mine shafts. I've heard the whispers. Maybe it's not such a great mystery after all. I'm not sure what much more needs to be said, folks. Spiv's a good man, and I think his tale holds its own weight. Thank you so much, sir, for writing in. Our final submission actually comes to us as a set of submissions. And the person, the Twitter mutual, sending them, wishes to remain anonymous, and we will absolutely honor those wishes. Story 1. The Haunted Neighbor. Next-door neighbors in Houston, Texas, are adding on to their 1910 house in the back, apparently to restore it to how it was originally designed. They had one group of contractors there for over a month, but one day it was finally quiet next door. The contractors had walked off the site and told the owners the place was haunted. The concrete example they gave was a worker said a hammer laying on the ground in the part where they were building, levitated, and then flew into the backyard. They had one frame of add-on up, so there were no windows yet. Contractors got spooked and ran off. Neighbors say they haven't seen or heard anything odd, but both are deaf and one is beginning to go blind. Without their hearing aids on, they can't hear anything. I've been 6 feet away from one of the guys, with his back turned to us, yelling his name, and he would hear nothing. Neighbors also said, after these first contractors left, that they don't believe in ghosts or any of that supernatural stuff. Then, about a week later, a second contractor quit because of a ghost sighting. These were different workers from a different company and had no idea what had happened to the other crew. One of the workers ran away from the house screaming, "Mujer malvada." My wife, fluent in Spanish, says it means evil, cursed, wicked, or damned woman. The neighbor, apparently, has looked into the history of the house. They've always been into historical preservation. And he said, "I have very detailed records on the history of the house, plus a lot of photographs." The original owner was a young widow with 3 kids from LaGrange who wanted to be near her mother, who lived at 501. Absolutely nothing sinister about her. She did live a long life and died of natural causes. We think whoever the spirit is may have been a renter, since the house also spent a long time as a rental. They think the former addition is where these renters would have lived. Once our neighbors finally found a third contractor, they developed a new theory of their own and told us, "We hired another contractor, the one who worked on our old house, and he found some serious deficiencies, illegal even, that a previous contractor's done here. Now, we are wondering, if there is indeed a spirit in the house, was she possibly scaring off the workers to protect her house from further damage?" What's interesting is these neighbors went from not believing in any of this stuff to having developed this theory completely on their own. My aunt spoke with a priest and former exorcist for a Catholic diocese. He said that there are benign and malevolent spirits. Benign are stuck in between and want attention. But he said the throwing of the hammer and the appearance of malvada shows it's malevolent. It's taking ownership of that space and doesn't want to be disturbed. So that's one person's explanation. However, we've had nothing strange on our side of the fence, and the neighbors are now back to saying they don't believe in spirits or the supernatural. Now, just a couple of things here. I think that that is really interesting in that it manages to hit all the main points that a person would commonly associate with this sort of reconstructive ghost story. You know, as listeners of this show, I wouldn't put it past any of you to already be aware that much supernatural activity has been attributed to disturbing the foundations of various buildings. In fact, that was believed to have been the cause of the Amityville haunting, for instance. And we also know that spirits are in fact quite territorial. So, whether or not there's something to this one, I'm inclined to say yes. It's hard to disbelieve when multiple witnesses are reporting the same type of spirit activity, but we may never actually know. They did, however, send us some more stories, so let's continue on. Number 2, the demonic aunt. My uncle was married to a woman who was absolutely terrible. Alcoholic, mean, etc. They would fight all the time, and she wouldn't let him talk to the rest of our family, so he was basically estranged to us for a few years. After they split up, he told us that one night he woke up basically in a state of sleep paralysis, at least as far as I understand that phenomenon, and he was frozen in bed but clearly awake. He saw a big black demon-like entity at the foot of the bed and approaching his side. He finally started to scream and woke his wife up. He asked her if she saw it too, and she just started laughing maniacally and said, "Oh, they're always with me." Now, I know that there are a lot of people out there who are sleep paralysis skeptics and who believe there's nothing more to it than an odd cocktail of brain chemicals wreaking havoc on our not-quite-waking mind. But I would love any of you who think you can explain this to email me at pause@timelineearth.org and, you know, just walk me through how one person can be experiencing the sleep paralysis and then have their partner physically verify it laying right next to them. I dare you, skeptics in the audience, to reason your way out of that one. Moving on, I'm going to go through one more of this writer's stories for you here. The Austin Orbs. My wife went on an Austin walking ghost tour. The whole way, she was taking pictures, trying to look for ghost orbs. One of the few stops was the historic Susanna Dickinson home. She was the woman who was famous for being one of the few survivors at the Alamo. She took a picture of this house. Later, when the group was all reviewing photos of the tour, looking for the orbs, she saw a face in the window of the Dickinson house. At first glance, it looked like the shadow of leaves, but she could distinctly see the contours of a face. She later drew the face from the window. It was a man with a thin face, wavy hair, and an old-fashioned beard and mustache, almost seemingly in a suit. Now, to the credit of our anonymous friend, they actually did me the service of attaching a digital copy of this photo. Now, I can say as a matter of fact that I see exactly what they're talking about when they say they see a face in the window. What that could be, I'm going to reserve comment, and to protect their privacy and distribution here, I'm not going to share it either. But, you know, next time you think you see some leaves dancing, I'd just ask, maybe you take a look just a little bit harder. There's a lot out there in the world, and if you think you can say something as simple as leaves and dismiss it, maybe you're not as open-minded as you might hope you are. Now, with these wonderful submissions out of the way, and please, anyone who's hearing this, feel free to email me once again at pause@timelineearth.org to get in on next month's mailbag. That'll wrap this one up, and I look forward to hearing from you all. We'll be back right after this break. Programming note, folks. As you may have heard there was a slight system interruption. Next, we will be going into the main subject of tonight's episode with my co-host from the Gaslight Hour, Ted. Please enjoy as the first minute or so wound up accidentally damaged in the stitching together of files. You have my apologies.
So, folks, the way I went about cracking open and digging through these files, a little note, I will include the links in your show notes so that you can find the information yourself. I will also publish you my research notes, such as they are. Now, the important thing that I really want you to remember, I'm going to emphasize this right now, I started at the bottom instead of the top. So if you try to follow along, go all the way to the bottom of the files first and open those in an ascending fashion. Okay? Okay. Now, to get us started here, the first batch is just a straight-up series of memos about UFO sightings from the 70s. This was at a point already, context-wise, in the 70s, where the U.S. government had more or less just decided it was no longer formally and on the books going to look at the UFO issue. Is that correct in your estimation also, Ted?
Yeah, they had the, I think it was late 1960s, they did the Colorado UFO report, the study for 2 years, and
the Condon report, yeah.
Yeah.
And they wrapped that up in like 67 through 69 or something.
Yeah, they basically didn't say UFOs aren't real. They said they're not a threat to the U.S. government, so we're officially getting out of the UFO game. And what they meant by that is, up to that point, as much as people, every time that there's some kind of release that goes on every few years, just completely deny, is that the U.S. government was pretty quote-unquote transparent about their involvement with UFOs as a phenomenon. They've had Project Blue Book, which was a public relations campaign more than anything else. It was a thing that happened. They weren't secretive that they were investigating UFOs, but they were using that study group or that project as more of a, hey, we're going to cover up secret projects. Like, they basically used it as an opportunity to cover up secret stuff and also kind of try to get people to not think too much about UFOs. They didn't have a fixed position. They didn't think that they were a threat after the Colorado study.
Yeah, that is precisely the way that happened, too. And that's something that, as we go through the study notes here and keep talking, we'll talk a little bit briefly about the timelines of the projects. But suffice it to say, the U.S. government studied UFOs for a long time and very publicly, but the way they went about it was never such that they were seriously investigating it, at least not in a public-facing manner. They engaged in a very long-winded and ultimately ineffectual debunking campaign that lasted from 1947 up until what we're talking about here, the Condon Committee wrapping up in 1968, 1969.
Yeah, and it should be kind of made clear that in the early 50s they had the Robertson Panel, which up to that point, the government's involvement in the study of UFOs was considered more or less classified. It wasn't something that they did publicly. The Robertson Panel was something that was, it was a more or less a think tank, like a couple day think tank, where the government had some scientists come in and they showed them evidence and they said, well, what do you guys think? And it was essentially the same resolution as the Colorado study group, the Condon Committee. What was that? 17 or 18 years later, they basically said...
Yeah, if you want to get into the specifics of that, I actually do have that data on the sheet, and we can jump around a little bit.
Yeah, because I think one of the main things... Go ahead.
The Robertson panel was 12 hours over the course of 3 days. They looked at 600 reports, and based on that sample size, were confident saying, this poses no national security risk. LOL, it's swamp gas.
Well, my favorite part about the Robertson Committee was they did have film that they showed to the people in the group while they were actually trying to go over it and analyze it. and they projected it onto just a solid mortar wall. So basically like the crap you see in halls and schools, just a white wall. They didn't use a projector or screen or anything like that. But the idea, or what they came up with in the Robertson panel was essentially, look, we don't have any evidence that this stuff is a direct threat, but it should be monitored, and the groups that investigate this should be monitored, because even in the early 50s, it's not really a secret anymore that the U.S. was developing secret side projects. They were testing military craft. They were doing a lot of weird stuff with atmospheric balloons. So a lot of the UFO reports could have been that kind of stuff. And that means that UFO groups were inevitably trying to figure out or prove why these secret projects were UFOs, because it wasn't good enough that they were secret projects. So they said...
And definitionally, too, though, a UFO is a UFO.
Yeah, it's a UFO to them. The term itself
makes no distinction between an alien and a drone.
It's a UFO to these study or these UFO groups that were actually looking into this stuff and trying to figure out why these things were aliens. So they were UFOs to them. But the Robertson panel said, well, look, if these guys are accidentally stumbling upon classified information, then maybe they might say, hey, Russia, well, not explicitly, like if Russian agents got into UFO groups, they would, you know, beat around the bush to try to figure out where secret projects were, because, well, there's UFO concentrated in certain areas, so that's probably where the U.S. is doing secret research with whatever they're researching.
Sure. Projects. And, you know, something like that does, in fact, pose a security risk to the United States government. So exactly. It's reasonable that they might take that approach.
Yeah. And up until the Robertson panel, they had the first UFO project was Project Sign, which started shortly after the Washington flying disc thing by What's-His-Face. I'm going to forget all the names.
Sign was already in effect. That was the first case that Sign opened up, but Sign did not open as a result of the Murray Island incident or the Maury Island incident.
Well, I believe Sign actually started in 1948. It's been years since I studied this stuff, but I think it started in 1948. They may have studied Maury Island.
I'm relatively certain it was in 47.
I gotcha. Well, the Maury Island one was a lesser known, but I think the guy that actually studied the Maury Island one was the person that made the headlines as the first person who sighted UFOs in Washington. I can't remember his name because it's going to be the I Don't Remember Names podcast today. The most famous UFO sighting, totally I can't remember his name.
Kenneth Arnold.
So this guy went in for Fate magazine, went to go look at the Maury Island affair, which is kind of a really funny UFO sighting in itself. But that predated his actual sighting in Mount Rainier, Washington. And the government eventually just over all the hoopla that these new sightings were pouring in, they created Project Sign because they wanted to know whether or not UFOs were from outer space and whether or not they were a threat. And they wanted to figure out what they were specifically so they knew what to deal with it. So they started Project Sign. And within, I think, 2 or 3 years, that closed out.
Sign closed after almost exactly 2 years, yes.
Yeah, so they closed that out because they weren't getting anywhere with it. They had hundreds of reports, but they couldn't figure out what it was. It didn't seem like it was an actual threat to national security. And
this actually became a chronic problem for them, too.
Yeah.
Because it was later revealed that Sign initially only had like 10 people working on it.
Yeah, it wasn't a lot.
By the time they closed it 2 years later, there was only one person, a lieutenant, sitting at a desk, who had no actual interest or... yeah, it was. He had no interest in the project and no background as a researcher, and they were just dumping these reports on him left and right. It was, you know, maybe not intentionally, but it was set up to fail.
Yeah, and I'd remember specific names, but it's been years since I've actually looked into the history of it, but... That closed out. There was somebody that had like a really, you know, strange Nazi-esque name that was, I think he was the one that either really believed in it or really wanted it to shut down because he realized the people that were involved in Sign were a little bit fanatical. And the people that were pushing it were a little fanatical and too invested in the ETA or the ET hypothesis. So they closed that out. And then there was another initiative to go back at all these unsolved cases because they had a problem on their hands that was we collected hundreds of UFO reports. We couldn't explain them away. And eventually, whenever this becomes public information, people are going to say, well, this means that UFOs are real, and they're going to draw conclusions from that. So they developed Project Grudge, which was essentially a dismissal campaign. They went through a lot of old reports and then new ones that poured in. Their entire goal was just figuring out weird conclusions to dismiss and close all these cases.
This was the Air Force specifically saying, hey, we need to shut down UFOs as a concept before they become a part of the public fascination.
Exactly.
And to their shame, they were actually only able to debunk about 0.3% of the cases they analyzed in Grudge, and the rest they merely had to dismiss as inconclusive.
Yeah, it was more they tried to use Grudge as like a way to close out all the Sign stuff and then everything that was still coming in. And I don't quite remember if Grudge closed out before the Robertson panel or because of the Robertson panel.
Robertson panel was a component of the next failed Air Force project, Blue Book. So yeah. It would have been after Grudge ended.
Which, to remind everybody, Project Blue Book wasn't a classified project. There were files that were classified with it, and some of their methods and their explanations were classified because some of it could have been involving top secret projects of the U.S. government. But the entire goal of Project Blue Book, because of the Robertson panel, was to kind of have a public relations campaign with it to trust science, to use the common vernacular nowadays. They wanted to explain away cases and get people to just think, well, this is just a normal natural phenomena, or it has reasonable explanations that aren't extraterrestrial or whatever other theories were at the time, which I think the ETH was by and far the most popular explanation for them. So,
it absolutely was. You know, even as early as the 40s, when this really began to take off with, you know, Sign and Grudge, people in the public were already assuming it's aliens from another planet. And for the record, they were never assuming historically that was little green or gray men. There were some reports of that, but early UFO pilots were distinctly humanoid.
Yeah. And like the fanaticism towards the ETH is one of the reasons that Sign closed out so quickly, because there were some people involved in Sign that were dismissed from the project because they were very fanatically, well, this must be an extraterrestrial phenomenon. And that's also one of the reasons that a lot of the cases didn't close during that project's duration. But the building of these two projects that eventually led to the Robertson Committee, the reason that I keep going to the Robertson Committee was, or the Robertson panel, was because every, like I said at the beginning of the episode, every 2 or 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, everybody's talking about disclosure. And every time that there's a dump of documents that were previously classified, people go straight to them and said, this is proof that UFOs exist. The government's admitting that UFOs exist. And it's annoying because they've been admitting that UFOs exist since the 50s. They had a public relations campaign that lasted damn near 20 years starting in the 50s after their more covert investigations, even though they probably weren't that classified to begin with.
Some of them certainly were. You know, if we could talk a little bit about early Blue Book and the Robertson panel real quick.
Yeah.
You know, the Robertson panel was a subset of Blue Book, and it is common knowledge already before this particular release that I've been looking at that the CIA funded the Robertson panel on behalf of the Air Force. Like, the Robertson panel as a subset of Blue Book was a CIA operation. It is still unclear why they funded this sub-panel for Blue Book, or what was going on with it. And that's actually created a lot of contention and stoked a lot of paranoia. I personally think rightfully so.
I think it was pretty clear in the Robertson panel that one of the objectives of Project Blue Book was to monitor and re-educate the public that were involved in UFO investigations. So there is the CIA element right there. They're trying to monitor and keep tabs on the people that are involved with the trends in the UFO field.
Not just that, however, because as I have found out in this document dump, I think for the first time, as historically confirmable, the Robertson panel report itself was classified for several years after they gave their findings to Blue Book, and it was eventually then declassified for public consumption. That is, the findings of this 12-hour panel. However, this is the part that has not previously been public knowledge, though it has perhaps been insinuated. The final report itself, even, had three whole paragraphs cut out at behest of the CIA commissioners of the Robertson panel. So even the declassified Robertson panel that we know today is not the complete document.
That's convenient. And you always have to at least suspect that a lot of these current document dumps, because the government was so ardently against the idea of UFOs, now it almost seems like the government and a lot of scientists are extremely pro not just UFOs, but the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And it's almost like we're watching in real time the government priming people for the expectation of extraterrestrial visitation, which is kind of weird because they've been historically against that for whatever reason. Because at the end of the day, the government probably knows no more about UFOs than anybody else on the planet. So they don't know if they're extraterrestrials. We don't know if the people in the government currently just have a wild hair up their ass and they're alien fanatics from the 70s, like the hippies. Because we got a lot of hippies in the government now. They just wear suits because I guess that makes them more credible.
Well, that's where we kind of start running into a problem too, though, isn't it? Because there's plenty of good reasons potentially for them to believe in the extraterrestrial hypothesis. You know, by the time Blue Book was up and running, we'd also already seen Operation High Jump's disaster with Admiral Byrd going to Antarctica.
And by where the ice wall is.
Well, you know, according to some, you know,
crashed right into it.
Some.
Yeah. I almost wonder if the new push for the UFO stuff, especially from the government, the declassification of old reports that at least the ones that were before this report, they weren't really anything new per se. They were just the same old shit. It was, okay, you declassified a bunch of UFOs. They don't prove anything. They don't disprove anything. It's just documents. So now we have this new push by the government.
The last three leaks previous to this one from the Black Vault, you know, the last three times the government has up and just released stuff of its own accord, it has all been stuff that has been previously privately leaked by whistleblowers. The government itself has not released anything new of its own accord in some decades. It has only gotten fucked by whistleblowers and then been forced to via FOIA, like what the Black Vault is so generously doing for us.
Yeah, it's very much, you get the sense of people get confirmation that, oh, well, the government's admitting that the stuff that was previously leaked, or you have the people that didn't know that that stuff previously leaked latching onto that and saying, well, this is proof that UFOs exist from the government, we're being visited by aliens, please give me more daddy. So we've got that sense. And there's also, like, I want to kind of make this point because I keep kind of derailing into other stuff, but we've got all these people in the government now trying to push for UFO declassification and more involvement from the government into UFOs, at least kind of Blue Book-esque. It's a more of a public relations thing. And I almost wonder if it's just like the government's involvement with climate change is just a money grab.
Well, we can safely assume that may have in fact been the case with previous Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, right? He had a very personal relationship with the infamous Mr. Bigelow, who has, to his credit, as one of the ultra-wealthy in America, done and privately commissioned several UFO studies, several paranormal studies, was the one-time owner of the Skinwalker Ranch, and in fact also set up a government contracting company specifically for alleged extraterrestrial materials.
Yeah, what isn't Bigelow the tea guy? Like he's got a tea empire.
I don't know if Robert Bigelow is the Bigelow tea.
I'm gonna say he is, but that's just my opinion. Don't sue the podcast.
Do not sue my podcast. I just got started.
Yeah. First day you already get banned because the guy's like, well, I don't remember making any tea. This is defamation. Like
okay,
that no, type of thing.
Robert Bigelow is not the tea Bigelow. He's a hotels guy.
Oh, well, there's still Bigelow tea. But yeah, the Skinwalker Ranch stuff is a little bit weird, and it's kind of hilarious in a way that Harry Reid's tied to that.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, to your point, that could be just a kickbacks situation.
Yeah, I almost wonder if it is, because the climate change thing's the same way. Like, hey, this is a real problem. You should give the government should create some kind of weird side project that gets a lot of money so that we can do nothing about it. Let's
now,
solve
just
no
being
problems.
A looting project for politicians, though, does yeah. not affect the nature of the phenomenon itself, nor necessarily how government subsidiaries react to a said phenomenon. You know, to push back at you a little bit here, it's pretty clear from the documentation that there are enough UFO believers, or there at least were in the government, that many of them, especially in the CIA, which is the pertinent branch for the files I've been researching, were researching this as a side project all through the 70s, despite having no official UFO projects on the books during the 70s.
Okay, so I just fat-fingered something, just so everybody knows if there's any continuity errors, it's completely my fault. But I was saying to the effect that there's been rumors at least since the 1950s or so that the CIA is somehow involved with the UFO phenomenon, whether or not they are an explanation for the Men in Black, or they're the ones that aren't the U.S. Air Force, because their U.S. Air Force was known to be involved in the UFO project. But there were always these elements within the government, allegedly, that were involved with it somehow, whether they were the ones strong-arming witnesses or what have you.
Well, that's the beautiful thing, you know. Based on, if nothing else, these documents alone, we can now affirmatively say that there's no allegedly about it. You know, I now have in my possession, and anybody else who wants to can have in their possession, lightly redacted and unredacted memos saying, so-and-so at the agency is looking at this, despite us having no active task force or project. So it's pretty clear that the Glowies themselves, specifically at Central Intelligence, they knew who their co-workers were, who were looking into this matter, even if they weren't getting special extra funding to do it.
Yeah. And with this, I think one of the more interesting things about this release that I've noticed is it actually admits that even after the Conan report, the government was still involved in UFOs, even though they officially claimed to get out of the UFO business.
Yeah.
Have you seen anything in there that linked it straight to the U.S. Air Force, or is it just CIA in there?
So, this whole document dump specifically is predicated on releases pertaining to the CIA and UFOs and to the CIA's specific activities. So, the only intersections with the Air Force are when the CIA had documentation referencing Air Force personnel or referencing Air Force activities. To this point, I want to stress again that I am legitimately only about 20% of the way through this files release.
Okay, so there might still be some meat in there.
Who knows what else I'm going to find.
I getcha. So far, what kind of interesting stuff you find in there?
Well, something that I've been treating as a real gem, and I wanted to talk to you about this, is someone saw fit to include an English reprint of a German newspaper from Argentina. Or Argentina, rather.
And what year?
Well, that's where it gets even wilder, right?
Yeah.
The file itself is referencing events in the early 1950s, but the people the article is talking about were all major players in airplane development in World War I and in the interwar period. Now, what this article was actually about, if you'll give me just a moment to explain it, is it's talking about a UFO that was sighted there in South America, and it's a couple of eggheads pushing back on it. Well, it must have been some kind of man-made craft. It was one of those old single-wing style of planes, which, you know, if they'd ever gotten them working in mass, would have resembled old saucers or UFOs. And the gentleman who wrote the article in the original German is talking about, oh, well, this jives beautifully with the gas turbine type projects that Hugo Junkers was working on in Germany in the aforementioned World War I and interwar period. So you have this German gentleman down in South America in the 50s, the early 50s, trying to explain away a UFO as some sort of prototype that could have plausibly been developed as early as the 1920s. Now, do you see where I'm going with this? Do you see why that's so interesting?
The only thing that I see interesting with it is the cultural, it's like backwards cultural tracking a little bit, but with technology that's not very viable. If that makes sense.
So,
but I'm sure you had something you were going to get at.
Yeah. So if he's referencing designs that have could have already been several decades old at that point, and with it being a German cultural enclave, I'm immediately personally seeing a connection to secret space program theorizing and paperclip nonsense. Especially because the article then goes on to cite the name of several professors who would have taken Hugo Junkers' design and have been improving upon it during the interwar period after Hugo died. One of these professors was deported right before World War II to the Soviet Union, and the other one I have not been able to find any traces of in history at all. I'm still doing my work on it, I'm still searching up his name. But so here we have a gentleman in a South American newspaper trying to explain away a UFO as a potentially viable craft that would have been developed by German researchers who just straight up disappeared.
See, the thing with that is I'm not really into the secret space project nonsense, really, because those people are insane. Not to shit on anybody's parade, but I just never really looked into it, so it didn't click at all for me.
Some of them are weird, and the talk show grifters in that space are, there's something else entirely, right? You know, you're absolutely right. The Corey Goods, the Michael Salas.
Those are like next level.
Those guys are bananas. But here we have an actual reprint of an actual newspaper article that's verifiable. I uploaded it to my Keybase team. I'm going to go ahead and plug that live on air here. Check it out. The file itself is right in there from the CIA dump. And you have them talking about the potential viability of something like this that could radically alter, you know, our understanding of the timeline of airplane travel if, in fact, that is what that was. And the article is some dude making the case that this is what that was.
Do you think that there's any potential that they they intentionally planted some of that stuff in the dump just to fuel certain people that would notice it?
That is absolutely possible. You know, I'm not dismissing that even a little bit, Ted. But at the same time, you know, is it there as an oddity? Is it there as a plant? Or is it there because some dipshit forgot to leave it out when he was supposed to pull it out for the dump?
I mean, it's the government, so it's really hard to say.
Well, right, that's just it. We cannot dismiss any of those possibilities. And true to what I'm trying to do with this project, I do not want any of the listeners to dismiss any of those possibilities. When I advocate a theory, or say, this looks like X, or this sounds like Y, do not take my word for it. That is why I am attaching the research notes, that's why I am showing you where to get the documents for yourself, and that's why I set up that Keybase team. I want us all to figure this out together, because I am concerned with getting it right once and for all.
Yeah, I think even that weird stuff like that, that could fuel newer conspiracies or empower existing conspiracies like the Secret Space Project, I would almost think that documenting those anomalies within dumps like this is probably important just in the effect of tracing psyops and stuff like that. That's kind of a curiosity for that genre of what we're involved in.
Absolutely. And, you know, this isn't what I wanted to talk about on this episode, so I'm not going to go into depth on this in particular.
We don't need to.
But as a teaser just for future content, it's mighty hard to look at some of the real loons in this space and wonder just why they're as screwed up as they are. You kind of see what I'm gesturing at with that?
Yeah. So, no MK Ultra here.
Right. That's totally not possible. It's just a coincidence that this guy became a schizophrenic after he got out of the army.
Completely coincidental. So with the dumps as of right now, is it all UFO stuff? Like purely UFO stuff?
Yeah, this one so far has been purely UFO related.
Okay, so nothing to do with like MKUltra-esque stuff or... I know we're not getting onto that in this episode, but none of that or any of their research into psi studies.
Not yet, but their psi studies in particular, I already have two other note sheets full. I was actually going to do this first episode on their psi studies until I realized that it was 15 gigabytes and 98,000 pages to go through.
98,000?
There are 98,000 in their declassified psi projects dump, yeah.
Jeez.
So well, I will be working through that in the future, but that's going to take a lot of time.
Well, I'm glad that you're the one doing it and not me. I'm just going to stick to other stuff. Other old stuff.
That's totally fine, brother. I suppose we're already coming up at about the length I wanted to go with this, and there's a lot of stuff we haven't even began touching here. But with the last 5 to 10 minutes or so we've got remaining, could you tell the listeners and talk to me just a little bit about your thoughts on Professor Hynek? Because he comes up pretty liberally in this set of files that I've analyzed already.
Well, I'm not the Hynek expert. We've emailed that guy. But I'm a big fan of Hynek's involvement with Project Blue Book, not for obvious reasons. So there is a TV show that's called Project Blue Book, and it features a fictionalized Alan Hynek. The problem with the show is it is extremely fictionalized. Pretty much every episode is not how any of that stuff happened. But the real Hynek was a little bit of an occultist. Like, he had interest in the occult before he joined got involved with the Air Force. He didn't join the Air Force. He was a professor out in, I want to say, Ohio or something. Yeah. So he got on to Project Blue Book as a consultant, which is about the only accurate thing in the TV show. And he was extremely skeptical of it because he was trained scientifically. Even though he was interested in the occult, he read occult books when he was young by Rudolf Steiner. So there's the Thelemic element there. So he already had like a different worldview. That's a name I
want you guys to take note of, listeners.
Yeah, the Rudolf Steiner. He's, I guess, German. So he had this interest in the occult, which kind of changes people's perspective on the UFO phenomena in general. Usually people that are well-read in the occult don't jump to the extraterrestrial hypothesis, and I don't think he did either. He did a lot of stuff pre-Project Blue Book during World War II with developing certain technologies, and I think his big contribution was some kind of, I don't remember if it was, it wasn't radar, I don't think. It was something tangential to that.
It was developments related to radar, but not as the radar itself operated in real time.
I almost think it was some kind of atmospheric thing, because, so whenever you're looking at space at night, which is debatably existing, we don't know if it's real. But anyways, you're looking at the stars and they're kind of twinkling. There's this atmospheric effect that's going on. And what he wanted to do was get telescopes or something high enough up in the atmosphere to where that lensing effect doesn't happen. So the atmosphere isn't a factor whenever you're looking into space, so that whatever you're looking at appears a lot clearer. So you don't have that mass between the telescope and space. So that's one of the things that he developed. And he got into Project Blue Book as a consultant, studied a lot of the cases, and he was skeptical of the UFO phenomena in general, but over the course of the years in Project Blue Book, he became a little bit less skeptical that they existed. He started becoming aware that they were real things that were happening without an explanation. I think around the mid-1960s, he met Jacques Vallée and was acquainted with him. They became friends. And Vallée was on this, an alternative hypothesis to the extraterrestrial phenomena. And him and Hynek formed the Secret College, I think is what they called
it. The Invisible College.
Yeah, I'm going to forget all the names. They formed the Invisible College, which was Jacques Vallée, Alan Hynek, William Powers, who was a psychologist, a lot of other people that are doctors and involved in academia. So their idea was to have a core group of people that were scientifically minded, who are very academic intelligentsia, to look into this stuff on their own time without being inhibited by the red tape of government involvement. And that was all happening during Project Blue Book. So around 1960, I want to say the swamp gas in Michigan happened in 65 or 66. So that was really the straw that broke the camel's back whenever it came to Alan Hynek, because he went to a place in Michigan that I'm not going to remember the name of, because that's the kind of night I'm having. He went to Michigan to investigate this UFO that was seen at a college there. And I've talked about this on the Damn Woods before, so it's probably a little bit clearer on that. But he went to go investigate this, and the descriptions that people were giving him weren't really lining up with anything. And in the area, the only thing that he could really come up with that would be kind of a plausible explanation was swamp gas, because swamp gas is a real thing. They saw lights in the woods. Well, swamp gas is a light, and it's usually in the woods because that's where swamps are. So the Air Force pushed him to explain this in a media release. But when that happened, it was kind of the implosion of the U.S. Air Force's credibility on UFOs, because there were these people saying, I know what I saw, I know what swamp gas looks like. This wasn't it. There were scientists at the college that said, you know, the swamp gas theory isn't viable because of this, this, and this. And they were looking into the science of swamp gas. So that kind of affected his involvement in Project Blue Book, to where he wanted to be less involved with it. He still did the case files and stuff like that. But he wasn't an ardent skeptic and dismissalist like the U.S. Air Force expected him to be. So he eventually became a consultant for the Condon Committee that happened in 1968, 1969 in Colorado, along with Jacques Vallée. They actually went up there and gave their spiel for, like, I think it was an hour or two, which was really the limitation of their involvement in the Condon Committee. They weren't really involved in it outside of that. They just kind of gave a debrief on the situation, like, hey, this is what we know about this stuff because we actually study it and are invested into the study of UFOs. And there's an entire saga from within the Condon Committee, which was written by one of the people that was dismissed from it eventually. And it's probably one of the best UFO historical books I've ever read. called UFOs, yes.
And I do believe in your generosity and your charity. Let me shout you out here. I believe you sent me a copy of that book, did you not?
I probably did, because I try to keep a copy or two on hand, because it's one of those books that's so unexpectedly good that you just want to share it with people. So the reason that I wanted to put that out there is because it might make good content in the future to actually like go through that book and discuss it. But I mean, it really wouldn't do the book justice, because it's just such a damn good book. But it shows how Condon is in basically this insane person who is running a UFO study group in Colorado, which the U.S. Air Force is given full authority to give their opinion that will determine the course that the U.S. government will take pertaining to UFOs, specifically the Air Force. And Condon isn't... I'm sorry?
Go ahead, finish your thought, and then I've got a comment on that.
I gotcha. So Condon is this insane professor who is in charge of organizing this study, and he's not really interested in UFOs at all. And he almost immediately says, well, there's nothing to the UFO crap, so yeah, we're going to do this for government money. And that's a pretty accurate start and reflection of what happens over the course of the next year or two.
Well, and that, as it turns out, is actually exactly what the Air Force wanted this whole time, too. Think contextually about everything else we've discussed here. Listeners, think contextually about the resources I will be publishing with the episode, and just realize the people leading these projects at the Air Force specifically did not want results, and they did not want questions. They wanted dismissals of the topic however they could get them. It was the CIA who was specifically interested in getting to the heart of the matter on UFOs. And whether or not they did, I don't know yet from the documents.
Exactly. Is there anything else that we needed to cover before we get off of here?
Well, there is a lot more I could discuss and that I may discuss in the future. We are nowhere near done with the CIA and UFOs, folks. So buckle up, they will continue to appear periodically. Before I let you go, Ted, and wrap things up here, is there anything you wanted to say?
Listen to the Gaslight Hour, where I will continue to get idioms and names wrong.
And he will also continue to share brilliant insights. Thank you so much for joining me, Ted. I really appreciate your time this evening.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.